first Julian Barnes, one of England's most acclaimed novelists and winner of the 2011 Man Booker Prize for his novel The Sense of an Ending. Barnes is fascinated by the way our minds play tricks with memory, especially as we get older. His prize-winning novel tells the story of a man in his 60s who's forced to confront an episode from his past. It involves an old girlfriend and a close friend who committed suicide. It's a story that raises questions about memory, aging, and moral reckoning. Steve Paulson asked Barnes to read a passage from the novel.
Later on in life, you expect a bit of rest, don't you? You think you deserve it. I did anyway. But then you begin to understand that the reward of merit is not life's business. Also, when you're young, you think you can predict the likely pains and bleaknesses that age might bring. You imagine yourself being lonely, divorced, widowed, children growing away from you, friends dying. You imagine the loss of status, the loss of desire, and desirability. But all this is looking ahead. What you fail to do is look ahead and then imagine yourself looking back from that future point, learning the new emotions that time brings. Discovering, for example, that as the witnesses to your life diminish, there is less corroboration and therefore less certainty as to what you are or have been.
This is really a novel about time and memory, isn't it? About how we make sense of a life as we look back on it?
Yes, that's right. And it's also about what happens when we discover that something we've believed for a long time turns out not to be the case, when some piece of evidence comes along which completely overthrows what we have assumed our life and our life's responsibilities to have been.
So to some degree, it's how we've, at times, I suppose, constructed a false history for ourselves.
I sort of agree with the narrator, Tony Webster, when he says, our life is not our life. It's the story we've told ourselves about our life.
So do you find yourself more preoccupied with these questions about time and memory than you were, I don't know, maybe 10 or 20 years ago?
Yes, I certainly do. I mean, I was thinking, someone asked me a bit ago, what's your next book going to be about? And I, without thinking, I said, well, it's going to be a book in which no one gets older. Everyone has a very good memory. No one dies, you know. And I think as you hit your 60s, you are certainly more concerned with what is the truth about your life and whether what you've assumed to be the truth and what you've told yourself is indeed related to what actually happened. I mean, one of the starting points for this book was a curious incident. When I was at school, I had a group of close friends. I went to one university, one of them went to another, and I lost touch with him. He was called Alex. And I continued to imagine, he was cleverer than I was, got a first-class degree and all that. And I sort of occasionally would find myself wondering what had happened to him, where he was in the world. Perhaps he was sort of high up in the civil service or maybe in the BBC or something like that. I thought I might run into him. And then when I was in my 50s, I met on the London Underground another of my group of friends from way back with whom I'd stayed in slightly more contact. And I said, do you see Alex nowadays? And he said, no, Alex killed himself when he was in his mid-20s. And so I realized that I had been, for 25 years of my life, I had been imagining this guy as still being alive. This is after I got over the immediate shock of his suicide. Imagining this guy alive for 25 years and then having to sort of recalibrate all those occasional memories and thoughts I've had of him. Also recalibrate what sort of a person he was to have killed himself and whether I could work that out in terms of what I'd known. I mean, I've had occasions where I've sort of subsequently rearranged history.
Well, tell me about the narrator of your novel, Tony Webster. How would you describe him?
I describe him as an ordinary, sensible chap who's tried to avoid too much difficulty in his life, who's tried to avoid conflict, who's not been, as far as he knows, unpleasant or nasty or malicious to anyone. He's now retired. He must be, therefore, in his early 60s, who had a marriage, but it went wrong. His wife left him for someone else, had a child. And he sort of made his accommodation with life, or he thinks he has, and has got through life without too much damage. It's about that as well. It's about someone who lives their life in a not exactly negative or passive, but in a slightly avoiding way.
One of my favorite lines is when Tony says, I don't like mess, and I don't even like leaving a mess. I've opted for cremation, if you want to know.
Yes. Well, that's the sort of guy he is, yes. And then he gets a lawyer's letter out of the blue, which sets him off on a trail in the course of which much of what he thought was the case turns out not to be so.
Well, it seems that there's an underlying, kind of terrifying question here, which is, what if we are not who we think we are?
Yes. I mean, I think unless we have a profoundly divided personality, we're something related to what we think we are. About 5 years ago, I wrote a book called Nothing to be Frightened Of, which was a sort of semi-memoir, and also it was about death. And it featured my brother. And we had a discussion, he and I, about memory. He's a philosopher. He's been a philosopher all his life. And he said that he regarded all memories as unsound, and memory as really being something much closer to the imagination than anything else. And I thought, that's just because he's got a bad memory and I've got a good memory. And that's the line I took in the book. And he also said to me when I was writing it, he said, by the way, if our memories conflict, choose yours over mine because yours is probably the sounder one, which I thought was extremely generous for someone who was going to appear in his brother's book. But in the sort of 5 years that have elapsed since I wrote that book, I'm almost coming round to my brother's point of view. And I feel that memory is not just unreliable and increasingly so through life, but that it is generated as much by the imagination as by any sort of, you know, exact record-keeping machine that we have up in our brain.
Well, you have another passage in the novel which gets at this idea exactly, and I'm wondering if you could read that for us. As
sure.
Tony is recalling a story that he's told himself, but he's wondering whether it's actually true or not.
Tony goes to Bristol, which is a university city, and that's where he meets Veronica, who's a fellow student, and they take up together. And he's remembering this when he's about 40 years later. That night, a group of us went to Minsterworth in quest of the Seven Boar. Veronica had been alongside me. My brain must have erased it from the record, but now I knew it for a fact. She was there with me. We sat on a damp blanket on a damp riverside holding hands. She'd brought a flask of hot chocolate. Innocent days. Moonlight caught the breaking wave as it approached. The others whooped at its arrival and whooped off after it, chasing into the night with a scatter of intersecting torch beams. Alone, she and I talked about how impossible things sometimes happened. Our mood was thoughtful, somber even, rather than ecstatic. At least, that's how I remember it now. Though if you were to put me in a court of law, I doubt I'd stand up to cross-examination very well. And yet you claim this memory was suppressed for 40 years? Yes. And only surfaced just recently? Yes. Are you able to account for why it surfaced? Not really. Then let me put it to you, Mr. Webster, that this supposed incident is an entire figment of your imagination, constructed to justify some romantic attachment which you appear to have been nurturing towards my client, a presumption which, the court should know, my client finds utterly repugnant. Yes, perhaps, but...
But what, Mr. Webster?
But we don't love many people in this life. One, two, three... And sometimes we don't recognize the fact until it's too late. Except that it isn't necessarily too late. Did you read that story about late flowering love in an old people's home in Barnstaple?
Oh, please, Mr. Webster, spare us your sentimental lucubrations. This is a court of law which deals with fact. What exactly are the facts in the case?
Oh, that is wonderful. Thank you. Now, you talked about how your last three books have been about death to some degree, and you mentioned your nonfiction book, Nothing to be Frightened Of, and in that book you said that you think about death every day, and sometimes it terrifies you enough that you wake up in the middle of the night sort of in fright. And I guess I'm wondering, if do you think that you are trying to work through this issue as you write these books?
No, not at all. I don't believe in the therapeutic use of literature. certainly not for the writer. I mean, sometimes literature can be therapeutic to the reader if, for example, its truth-telling is such that it makes the reader realize things about his or her life that they hadn't before. But in terms of the writer, I've never believed that if I was depressed and wrote a novel about someone who was depressed, I would get less depressed. It doesn't work like that for me, and I never expect it to work. I just thought that when I wrote Nothing to be Frightened Of, I thought, actually, there hasn't been enough about death lately, and we don't think about it enough.
Well, I'm wondering if there's actually a scarier idea than death, and that is decline as you age. It will happen to everyone if you live long enough. The prospect that you become a lesser version of yourself. Is that something that worries you?
Oh, yes, yes. And I think people tend to divide into one of two categories. They either fear death or they fear dying and the approach to dying, i.e. they fear, you know, senility, impotence of all faculty and that sort of thing. My position on this is that you can actually fear them both at the same time. I fear not only dying and bits of me falling off and imbecility, but also a non-existence. But I think one of the things we've done, we've sort of shifted our fear of death onto our fear of decrepitude. The great early writers of our culture, like Montaigne, when they wrote about death, they said, you die twice. You die when you lose your youth, and then you die, finally, when you lose what it is that has replaced your youth. But I think with better general health, we're pushing off the problem of bits falling off us mentally and physically until a later stage. I think that also means that we're not really very good at being old. We think that the best way to be old is to pretend we're still young. You know, I'm now in my 60s. People say, I don't feel any older than I did when I was in my 20s. And I always say, whether it's true or not, I always say, I feel a lot older. I feel a lot older than when I was 20, and I know a lot more stuff than when I was 20. I can't run as fast, but, you know, I can think faster, that sort of thing.
Julian Barnes, talking with Steve Paulson. Barnes won the 2011 Man Booker Prize for his novel The Sense of an Ending.
The time deniers say, 40's nothing. At 50, you're in your prime. 60's the new 40, and so on. I know this much, that there is objective time, but also subjective time, the kind you wear on the inside of your wrist, next to where the pulse lies. And this personal time, which is the true time, is measured in your relationship to memory. So when this strange thing happened, when these new memories suddenly came upon me, it was as if, for that moment, time had been placed in reverse, as if, for that moment, the river ran upstream.